Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
It's Wednesday, January 16th, 2013, and this is KBIA's Views of the News, a weekly take on news media performance from the studios of the Reynolds Journalism Institute at the Missouri School of Journalism. I'm Mike McKean, director of the Futures Lab at RJI. Here with me for today's program are J-School colleagues Charles Davis and Amy Simons, who's sitting in for Lee Wilkins. For most of our show this week, we'll examine recent business decisions by media organizations, some of them questionable. Cyclist Lance Armstrong will admit doping in an interview with Oprah Winfrey airing tomorrow night and Friday on her cable channel. Each of them is getting more from the chat than just a good story. CBS, the parent company of CNET, makes the tech site rescind an award because of a legal dispute with the recipient. The Atlantic withdraws an advertorial about the Church of Scientology in response to withering criticism. A judge says news companies cannot use photos from social media without the consent of the photographer. The New York Times eliminates its environment desk but claims it won't adversely affect environmental coverage. CNN has shut down its long-form investigative unit, or at least cut back, and draws scathing critiques from The Daily Show. And we'll look at how some media are profiting from the debate over gun control. Let's start with the Lance Armstrong interview that Oprah will air tomorrow night and Friday on her OWN cable network. Winfrey conducted the 2.5-hour session Monday. She tells Gail King on CBS This Morning it's, quote, the biggest interview I've ever done.
I would say he did not come clean in the manner that I expected. It was surprising to me. I would say that for myself, my team, all of us in the room, we were mesmerized.
Well, Charles, before we talk about what's in it for Oprah, let's talk about what's in it for Armstrong. Given all of the legal liability he potentially faces, why would he choose Oprah to come out and admit his guilt?
Well, she's sort of the celebrity interlocutor. You know, she can come at him fairly hard while still maintaining this patina of kind of softness and celebrity gentility. He certainly wasn't going to go in 60 minutes, so he had to have a venue that was guaranteed to garner eyeballs. What's in it for him ultimately is I think he's angling for a return to triathlons so that he can create a revenue source for himself, probably to pay lawsuits in the future.
According to a story in the Wall Street Journal, Amy, he was thinking, Armstrong was, about maybe giving an interview to a newspaper. Then he talked about maybe producing a documentary or even writing his own book. But ultimately, he decided to go with Oprah. Do you agree with Charles that this is probably a less tense environment for him to get his message out?
Not only a less tense environment for him to get the message out, but in a way, Oprah needed him just as much as he needed Oprah. This is, I don't know if I would say this is the biggest interview of her career, as she is, but it's the one that's either going to make or break the future of her career. Face it, I'm in that target age range of people who she's trying to reach, that 25 to 54 female audience. If I've watched OWN 3 hours since it's been on the air, that would be a lot. And if you can't reach that audience, this is her shot, last shot possibly at doing that.
And in fact, we've seen that she's kind of taken a hands-off approach in terms of her own appearances on the OWN network. I mean, there have been some exceptions. And when she does do her celebrity interviews, the ratings shoot up. And we saw that at least it looks like they've sold out all the ad positions for this interview at premium rates.
Yeah. Well, but again, it's kind of a one and done or a two and done now that it's been split up into two episodes. And who knows that those advertisers are really going to stick around because the content isn't there beyond this one interview.
I thought it was interesting that clip we showed you from CBS News. She gave that exclusive preview to the morning show maybe had something to do with the fact that Gayle King, her longtime friend, is also the host of that program. Well, CBS also created its own controversy, Charles, this week with a sketchy business decision. CBS owns CNET, which is the popular technology news site. CNET was covering the annual Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas. Its journalists had voted to give their annual Best in Show award to The Hopper. If you haven't seen the commercials for it, The Hopper is a digital video recorder. It's sold by Dish Network, and it can push TV content from your TV to your iPad without having an internet connection. But The Hopper also has a feature that automatically skips through commercials, and that's where the suits from CBS come in. They're suing Dish Network over this ad-skipping technology, so they told CNET they had to withdraw The Hopper from the competition for their award and choose somebody else. Well, that didn't go over very well with the journalists at CNET, as you can imagine. So the story leaked out, and CBS went on the defensive. According to an official statement, CNET now has a policy against reviewing products of companies involved in litigation with its parent company. But CBS insists that CNET maintains, quote, editorial independence and always will in terms of covering, quote, actual news. Soon after that, one of CNET's veteran reporters quit. Charles, what a mess.
This is a textbook lesson in corporate mendacity and executive stupidity. If you watch this thing over the course of the last few days, it went through sort of stages of, I guess I would call them stages of stupidity, which began with just sort of, oh, a day in the life of a CEO stupidity, in which Moonves comes down to the CNET journalist and says, we want to pull The Hopper out of this competition. They're at this giant electronic show in Vegas. They're about to announce the Best in Show. It's going to be The Hopper. Word gets out, I guess, in the corporate suite, and they go, no, you can't do that because we're suing these guys. Well, if you start making a list of all the people that a multinational media conglomerate is suing, you're going to take out a whole lot of product. Then they go, I think, stage two stupid, sort of DEFCON 5 stupid, really, is trying to parse out editorial independence for journalistic content from editorial independence for reviews. CNET made its living doing reviews. It's why it exists. It's why they paid $1.8 billion, with a B, for CNET. So it's just an amazing textbook example. J Schools will be talking about this for the next decade.
Yeah, Amy, that distinction between, quote, actual news and product reviews seems laughable.
It's absolutely laughable because the product is the news. Right. It's a new product and people want to know what it is, how it works, how well it works. To try and to claim that a review isn't actual news, it's absurd.
So how much damage do you think this is going to have to either CNET's or CBS's reputation in the long run?
Well, I think if they don't reverse course and reverse course dramatically along the lines of, we are extraordinarily sorry, we have gotten this wrong at every turn, we're backing it up, it's going to do tremendous damage. CNET's going to have a hard time. And by the way, CNET is the unfortunate victim here. They've done everything right, journalistically, ethically. They have done everything right. They've tried to be even more transparent than CBS. And at some points they have been, which is dangerous business, I think, when you're CNET. But if they don't walk it back, then CNET's going to have a hard time, through no doing of its own, maintaining any sort of editorial integrity when it comes to reviewing products.
So, Amy, do you think there is value in them walking it back at this point, and are they likely to do it?
I don't know that they are going to be likely to do it, but we'll have to wait and see what happens there.
Well, one way that media companies make up for declining revenues these days is to sell sponsorships for online content. And sometimes this can lead to the content looking suspiciously like a normal news story. And that's where the venerable magazine The Atlantic stepped in it this week. On Monday afternoon, appearing in the slot on the website where The Atlantic runs its own stories and columns, was a bit of paid puffery with the headline, David Miscavige Leads Scientology to Milestone Year. You can see a screenshot here if you're watching our vodcast. Reporters for other publications noticed this. They started asking questions. Then came the parodies. The Onion ran a sponsored article headlined, "The Taliban is a vibrant and thriving political movement." Boing Boing weighed in with, "Dread Cthulhu leads his cult to milestone year," a reference to H.P. Lovecraft's mythic monster with the octopus head. Well, by midnight, the Scientology advertorial was gone. By yesterday morning, The Atlantic had issued a three-word apology. We screwed up. So where was the screw-up really, Charles? Was it in running the sponsored content in a news slot, or was it really running content sponsored by the Church of Scientology that got them in so much trouble?
Maybe a little bit of both, but certainly I think it leans more toward running content that is pure advertising in something that was labeled sort of advertorial, I guess. It was propaganda, basically disguised as content. And the difficulty, I think, lies in the fact that in the world of digital publishing especially, the right hand needs to know what the left hand is doing. And I think ad sales are out doing their thing, and it's all being done digitally. So, you know, somebody shoots over an email and says, we'll pay you this if you run that. And if you don't have coordination of the policies and the guidelines for what advertorial is and what acceptable use is when it comes to content, then these sorts of things can creep in. I loved The Atlantic's apology. I think maybe they should do some consulting over at CBS because that's the sort of apology that is so rare in our business. It was quite refreshing.
I think another thing that they need to apologize for, Amy, is the fact that not only did they run this advertorial content, but they let their marketing department scan the comment section.
That's the biggest problem that you run into here, because there are plenty of other publications that are doing sponsored content, and the fact of the matter is, not all of them are as transparent as this was. This at least did have a little tag at the top near where you would find a byline that said sponsored content. But the comments at the bottom of the story were all so very clearly pro-Scientology that it was clear to anybody involved that there wasn't that whoever was monitoring those comments was doing it with a point of view in mind.
And they admitted it was their marketing department doing
that. Exactly, and that came out, but that it was somebody that was furthering that message. But, you know, we do see this sponsored content all over the place, in BuzzFeed, in Gawker. And, you know, to The Atlantic's credit, along with that great apology, they did have some kind of a disclaimer at the top, sponsored content, even if it wasn't as clear as using the word advertisement that most people may have been more familiar with.
Well, and down the road, I think it points to the need for us as educators in this world to talk with our students very closely, and for the certainly in The Atlantic and in other publications, for the two sides of the wall, the advertising, the editorial sides, to get together and coordinate policies with regard to marketing use of comments, for example, because I see it all the time. Gawker does it famously. But I see news sites that are clearly doing it too, where you've got people that are pumping up comments under a story that, let's say it's an auto, and you're in some auto magazine. They're notorious for it online. Mm-hmm. And they go in and people start pumping up comments. And then you'll see links being thrown in. Oh, here's a great place to buy floor mats and that kind of stuff. And man, that's insidious, and it really undermines the credibility on the editorial side.
Well, you can defend sponsored content if it's done appropriately, but one way that media companies are definitely not supposed to make money is by taking other people's copyrighted work and using it without permission. That happened in a case involving the wire service Agence France-Presse and photographer Daniel Morrell in the aftermath of the 2010 Haiti earthquake. Charles, you brought this story to our attention, the court decision by a judge this week. Fill us in a little bit on the background.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. In the aftermath of the earthquake in Haiti, as you can imagine, Haiti being as economically devastated as it was even before the earthquake, there are very few journalists, let alone photographers, on the ground. And so this photographer in Haiti had some of the first images that were coming out that were really quite gripping. Agence France-Presse started grabbing them off Twitter and using them pretty, it wasn't real subtle. They were just taking them and using them. The argument, and by the way, if you go back, what, 3 or 4 years, I guess, in the world of social media and the law, there wasn't a whole lot of recognition that someone's personal photography was theirs. I mean, this is only now emerging as sort of a doctrine. And so this opinion itself is pretty important, because it's first of all, extraordinarily clear and concise. I mean, the judge flat out says, just because you post something to a social network does not mean that you relinquish intellectual property of that photograph. And if you are a photojournalist and you make your living on the backs of photographs. That's a very important ruling.
And in fact, I mean, Amy, the judge was saying basically that even though the defense, AFP, was using was, well, Twitter's terms of use say you can, you know, forward other people's content, that that didn't bypass the original intellectual property rights.
There's a very, very big difference between forwarding other people's content and republishing other people's content.
But news media do what AFP did every day.
It doesn't make it right.
I know.
And when I train, journalists, that's the first thing I tell them. Social media, it's so accessible. If somebody's putting a photo out there and you want to publish it, it's not hard to get to them to ask for permission or to arrange for those rights. And it's lazy of journalists to simply republish something they don't have the rights to do just because it's on the internet.
So well, I think that laziness will be removed by opinions like this, because suddenly the force of law is sitting behind what we had been telling our students is the ethical thing to do, now becomes the legal thing to do.
I wonder though, I mean, AFP had the opportunity to settle this. I mean, they knew that they had made a mistake, really, but this is going ahead and going to trial. Why?
Bad lawyering would be my guess. I mean, obstinate. I really think the idea that you can establish a legal principle that a taking of someone's intellectual property is somehow conditioned on the social medium upon which it lay is absurd on its face, but I guess if you're them and you're already in the position of having to defend the indefensible, you just keep right on defending it.
Well, while media companies are covering their legal flanks, they're selling out to sponsors, they're grabbing photos from social media, they're also trying to improve the bottom line by reorganizing and cutting staff. Two more examples came to our attention this past week. First, the decision by the New York Times to close its environment desk in the next couple of weeks and reassign its 9 reporters and editors to different departments. Now, the Times top brass is saying they're not reducing environmental reporting. Instead, they claim that news about the environment is no longer compartmentalized or isolated, but it intersects with so many other beats like business and the economy. And so their decision, they say, is to integrate those journalists organizationally. Or to quote the Times' respected .earth blogger, Andrew Revkin, he says they're embracing a collaborative post-departmental journalism. Amy, do you buy that explanation?
Maybe I'm naive, but I do. And I look at other areas where there's been bleed over, where business has now become every bit as much of the sports beat, and understanding the business of sports and hirings and firings and different teams that have gone public. And it's like we tell our students here, almost every story could have a business angle. The way things are changing with global warming, with different types of environmental issues, I think we're going to find that there's a need for more environmental reporting across all different beats. And I personally do buy it, but
I mean, at the very least, Charles, I mean, whether you buy the argument or not, I think the timing of the decision certainly creates a perception problem for the Times.
Well, yeah, and I guess where I'm troubled, I mean, I kind of understand Revkin's contention that we're in this post-departmental world, and Amy's right. I mean, everything is sort of merging when it comes to our societal interest in climate change versus what is environmentalism if not business at the end of the day, and politics and all sorts of things. The problem, though, as I think we all can attest, is that beats have served newsrooms really well over the years, not just as organizational structures, but as deep wells of expertise. And that's where I'm concerned, that you don't have somebody who gets up every day at the New York Times and says, I am an environmental reporter. And as such, I'm going to spend my day thinking only about environmental issues. And if they take those people and just disperse them into the newsroom with the hope that, oh, they'll still cover the environment, they're going to get pulled on by a lot of competing desks.
Yeah, and I think sometimes we do make the mistake of drawing too many conclusions from the New York Times and applying them to others. We talked about that with the Snowfall story last week. They still have 9 reporters and editors who are trained to cover the environment. How many other news organizations really come anywhere near that?
How many can say they have one is trained specifically
cover
the environment?
The Columbia Journalism Review just reported this in this current issue, that back in 1989, there were 95 newspapers in this country that had weekly sections about science, and now there are only 19 such papers. And this is at a time when I guess you could argue that science is more critical to our lives than it's ever been.
Yeah.
Well, we've been talking a lot about the bottom line today, and I suspect ultimately, Charles, that Times executive editor Dean Baquet had it right when he said about this, about environmental beat especially, but about any specialty reporting, he said, if it has impact and audience, it will survive.
Yeah, and that says something about audience where environmental coverage is concerned. I mean, the Times has done extraordinary work, and I think they always have to have this internal debate at the Times between audience and impact. And the fact that when they do these, you know, 6,000-word thumbsuckers on environmental coverage, say Ian Urbina's work on fracking that he did over the last couple of years, it's amazing stuff. And the body of work is probably, I don't know, 100,000 words. It had tremendous impact. I don't know how much audience it built for the Times. And that audience conversation is becoming increasingly important.
Well, as you may recall, CNN closed down its own environmental and science and space department a couple of years ago. I think it was 2008, I believe, if I'm not wrong. And last year, they started laying off dozens of employees in their documentary unit, which produces a lot of their long-form investigative stories. Well, Monday night, The Daily Show on Comedy Central spoofed this alleged lack of interest in investigative journalism. Faux correspondent John Oliver made his point by interviewing real TV consultant Brad Adgate.
Let's say I knew an investigative journalist doing an investigation on Guinea-Bissau becoming a haven for drug smuggling.
Yeah.
Now, does that sound interesting?
No.
That doesn't sound like an interesting story.
Well, you could go stay in the United States and do that.
Right. But it's a good story, Brad.
Yeah, but, you know, there are a lot of good stories out there that, you know, we'll never know.
Yeah, we'll never know because people like you say they're not profitable.
Exactly.
Yeah, because you're saying exactly like that's a good thing.
Yeah, but you don't have to fly to some remote location, you know, to interview someone. You could just sit and use Skype and save money that way.
Yeah, but Brad, I don't know how many child soldiers in Sierra Leone use Skype.
Well, you might say that the consultant sounds kind of clueless, Charles, but I mean, that is the mentality, that is the rationale behind a lot of the cutbacks we see in investigative and trend reporting.
Yeah, I mean, we've talked about this many times, the illogical nature of investigative reporting itself. It's time-consuming, it's resource-heavy, and it angers powerful people. If you put all that together against this myopic focus, particularly on the broadcast side of the coin, Well, no, I wouldn't even say that. I'd say across journalism right now, this myopic focus on audience building and trying to find revenue, it's a terrible time to make the argument for investigative reporting, even though we've never needed it more.
It seems like an endangered species and not just on network television.
No, it's something that you're seeing in print. You're even seeing it online where you have this infinite space to go. You don't have limitations of newsprint. It is expensive to go to faraway places to interview people, to get the images that you really need. But there are all those stories out there we're never going to hear, we're never going to know, and the world is less for it.
Well, they may be cutting back on investigative journalism, but CNN is embracing another kind of journalism, advocacy journalism, at least as it concerns one of their talk show hosts, Piers Morgan. And you wonder if the bottom line might not be the chief reason for that. Morgan has been especially passionate about gun control since the Newtown shootings, and some gun advocates have even tried to launch a petition drive to have the British transplant deported. But speaking to some 600 employees yesterday in New York, the new president for CNN, Jeff Zucker, defended Morgan's right to speak out on gun violence, Charles, and despite past attempts by the network to claim the high ground by positioning itself as being nonpartisan, Zucker says he's in favor of CNN talent expressing their opinion, quote, where it was appropriate, whatever that means.
And that's been CNN's great balancing act that they failed miserably at over the last few years, is trying to figure out the appropriateness of opinionating on air. And the temptation is mighty, I think, because, I mean, you look at the numbers. Nancy Grace, you know, whatever that is, I hesitate to even call it opinion.
It's just screaming.
Yeah, pure out.
It's just screaming.
Road rage.
Yeah.
Outdraws Anderson Cooper, you know, on a nightly basis. That's got to make CNN executives crazy. But it's part of trying to straddle this news and and non-news world that CNN finds itself in.
Do you think that Zucker is giving Morgan kind of a special dispensation, Amy, because he is up against the likes of Sean Hannity and Rachel Maddow, and really most people don't think of him as a, quote, journalist?
I think that's exactly it. And this is something that hasn't, you know, Piers Morgan has been outspoken about gun control going, it's been before Newtown. I remember watching him getting into screaming fights with people over the summer after the shooting in Aurora, Colorado. So this just kind of gave him the ability and open the door for him to get loud again, if you will, and to get loud about something that people are so outraged about that he can be loud for a prolonged period of time. And that's helping CNN.
But I do wonder where it bleeds over. I mean, you certainly know that the journalists of CNN are more careful, more circumspect about what they say. But I mean, you do see opportunities for them to give their opinion on issues that seem a little less controversial. At what point does the barrier come down, if that barrier really matters anymore?
I get the sense that CNN is organizing itself into two separate camps, journalists and news shows, and then the celebrities. And so you've got Piers and you've got Nancy Grace, and they're trying to sort of array day parts that will, it almost looks like they're interspersing them now. News, celebrity. Piers Morgan was a journalist in the Fleet Street sense of the term. Mm. I think now he is Larry King starter.
He's
kit,
a personality.
Right?
He's a personality.
I am struck by the irony, really struck by the irony of people who embrace the Second Amendment trying to deny the First Amendment rights of people. That just thrills me.
Well, speaking of the Second Amendment, President Obama announced plans today to submit legislation to toughen America's gun laws, including a ban on assault weapons, limits on high-capacity magazines, more background checks. He also promised to issue some executive orders to increase enforcement of existing gun laws. And earlier this week, New York's legislature approved some of the toughest gun restrictions in the country. But Charles, the lawmakers also inserted a provision that makes it illegal now to release the names and addresses of gun owners from a new statewide database they're creating, and also gives those owners the right to keep county governments from giving out that information. Now, as we know, this stems from that decision by the New York Journal News right after Newtown to put out the names of gun owners from two counties on a map. And I just wonder, you know, I mean, big data is all the rage in journalism circles these days. We create databases, infographics, and the like that illustrate all kinds of trends that we might not otherwise see as obvious. But there have been some prominent journalists in this particular case who say they agree with critics that paper should not have published those names without putting them in some sort of meaningful context.
Yeah, I mean, I thought the act itself was sort of needlessly provocative. I defend it. They were public records. You can certainly use public records any way you see fit. I think as a news decision, it was questionable. And I think some of the debate surrounding it makes a lot of sense. If you were to use those, for example, those public records to document how often concealed weapons are involved in gunplay, well, then you're adding some news context to a story for right, which that data is very important. Unfortunately, because I think these sort of provocative uses of this gun permit data have been done, and this, by the way, New York was probably the sixth or eighth time this has been done around the country, the outrage around that built up to the point that now what you're going to get, I don't hesitate to predict, is wholesale closure of that data. Most states already, including Missouri, close it anyway. And what that does is impact any kind of public policy reporting over the effect of concealed carry, over the effect of handguns.
And the ban is probably the wrong answer because there are, as you say, useful ways of cross-referencing databases like gun owners with, say, bus drivers or school teachers or whatever with criminal convictions. That kind of stuff could be very useful. Well, we've been talking about financial motivations today, and public radio needs to make money too, so we're going to wrap it up and make room for KBIA's next program. But before we go, thanks to Amy for taking Lee's place this week. Thanks to our technical team, RJI's Travis McMillan and KBIA's Pat Akers. And thank you for listening and watching. If you want more background on today's topics, go to our blog under the Talk Shows tab on KBIA.org. You can also leave us comments, questions, or suggestions there, or email them if you like, to views@KBIA.org. I'm Mike McKean. Please join Charles, Lee, and me again next Wednesday for another edition of KBIA's Views of the News.